What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Gray Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order, except sometimes I just take you on the ride that my brain is going on, everybody. The theme in March has been gimmick. So we are, in our issue reviews, exploring some of the weirdest versions of the X-Men. Today we're jumping back to a little read, probably little known, 2003 book called Gus Beezer by one Gail Simone, who was writing a lot of Deadpool at the time, future scribe of Uncanny X-Men, of course. I am here with some new friends who have a new X-Men pod in our little sub-weird little queer X-Men pod community out here. I got to meet these two at some recent cons last year, and I'm thrilled to be featuring the hosts of the Incredible Mutant Studies podcast on Gray Malkin Lane today. Let me have you both introduce yourselves with your name and pronouns. Tell us a little about you. And my initial question is, I just want to hear a little of your origin story. X-Men fans into podcast hosts. And tell me about your friendship as well.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for that wonderful introduction. My name is Morgan Ward. I'm the host of Mutant Studies 101. I'm one of the professors there, as we like to say. I guess I'll give like a little spiel for our show and then talk about myself too. We're an academically unserious podcast about the X-Men, so if what we do is we take academia and we take X-Men comics and we merge them all together, which is kind of my origin story. I'm a grad student studying comic books, which is actually the first time I've said that out loud, which is pretty cool because it's a relatively new change.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So that's how I found X-Men, through the online community. I've been a lifer. I've been reading comic books since I could read anything. In fact, like, some of the first stuff I read were Calvin and Hobbes comics, which is going to be really relevant today.
Yep. I've got a list of things to talk about, and Calvin and Hobbes is on that list.
On that list, for sure. For sure. And it just kind of completely raptured me, because it's, as a scholar, it's everything that I think that the medium can do, and it's so vast, it's so huge. But then also, just as like a fan, the community that builds around X-Men comics is like no other. So I've met wonderful people like yourself, Chad, but also like my friends and other colleagues just through talking to people about like Days of Future Past.
I love you using the word scholar to describe yourself. Let me also welcome Dean to the show. Hi, Dean.
Hi. Yeah. Hi. I'm Dean Coburn. He, they pronouns. I am the other professor of Mutant Studies 101. I think Morgan described what the show is far better than I can. So I would like to kind of go into a little bit of the origin story of the podcast, which was like me and Morgan were friends on the internet for a really long time. And I believe the initial pitch for like our first episode and like what made us think we should have a podcast is we were thinking about like the real world implications of the trial of Magneto. That was kind of our first big one.
That is.
And we were like, we were just texting back and forth.
We said, what does it mean for Gabby Haller to declare that Eric Lenscher actually didn't do all that? And okay, then it became international law.
Yeah. So that was like, and we were like, we were joking about it. And then it also turned into us talking about like the real world implications of Alison Blair, the Disco Dazzler, our unofficial the unofficial mascot of the show, the person the two of us are more obsessed with than any human being has a normal right to be. We've dedicated like 8 hours of our lives to talking about her. But then it kind of became this more scholarly thing as we sort of kept working at it, and Morgan kind of discovered, we discovered a real solid formatting for how we kind of wanted to do the show. And then cut to nearly 2 years later, and we've been doing this consistently since, and it's been absolutely delightful.
As a guy who once made a decision to launch a show, there's a very big difference between figuring out your format or like what you want to do or where your interest lies and then doing it for years consistently, right? I'm always thrilled when someone new enters the community. Some newer recent friends like Escape the Mojoverse and X-Men Horoscopes and you guys and the X-Men podcast from Australia. Like, it's so fun to see new figures. How's it been for you integrating into this kind of queer online sub X-Men world? It's a beautiful space.
Yeah, I think it's been, I always say that I understand why to a lot of people, like content creator might feel a little like of a weird way to describe yourself. But I think really it was through FlameCon and specifically meeting Chad at FlameCon and the variety of people there that I really found that level of connection. Because frankly, we started the podcast and then about 3 to 4 months later, I kind of quit social media semi-cold turkey. And so there wasn't really a way for me to like necessarily reconnect with a ton of people through that. But then like having a physical real world gathering space that allowed me to like suddenly meet all of these other people has also been really wonderful.
I remember that phone call very well. I remember like you called me and you were like, this is like, I think that was the moment for you where it was like, this is real. This is a real thing. And for me, I was like, yeah, of course this is a real thing. This is like what we're doing. This is what we do. But it took finding community for you for this to be like, oh, this is incredible. And
the real world continues when we're doing you know, artsy things with our brains.
Yeah, pun not intended. I'm very cerebral. I'm very like, I am so thinky about like everything that if it weren't for Dean constantly like bringing me to events or saying like, you should go to this thing, you should talk to this person, I never would, because I'm so much more content to be like, and what if I sit here and wrote something instead, and maybe that's good. And so that's kind of why I think we work too.
That's excellent. I love smart, cerebral friends. We're going to have a good time. I do a lot of academic shit on my show. So if you have fun, be prepared for invitations back as well, because I'm doing lots of nerdy character analysis and trials and things all the time. For today, we're going to jump into a very non-academic space, but we're still going to treat it academically, which is a fun thing. Earlier this month, I reviewed The World Where the X-Men Are on a team called the Power Pachyderms. They are all elephants. It's nonsense. But we had a big conversation on the show about this trend in the late 80s to have like animal parodies of things from the Ninja Turtles right down the line, right? We also love like a gross out factor, like, which is a big thing in the late 80s, early 90s. We
go Garbage Pail Kids.
Ren and Stimpy, Beavis and Butthead. There's a lot of this kind of thing. And for those of you that got to hear the show I opened the month with, which will come out before this, it's an intense interview with Jim Salicrup and Glenn Herdling all about Marvel's parody magazines over the years. So we get to have a lot of fun. So we're going to treat this academically, but we're jumping into a very different world here that is not one I think most people want to say they enjoy their time in. I'm going to start us from a crazy place. I grew up in the Missouri Ozarks in the 1980s, primarily. I was right there in Tom Sawyer country. So Mark Twain writing Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn is one of the first, not the first, examples of kind of a bad kid as the protagonist of a story, which is already an interesting place to take this. Tom is playing tricks on people. Huck is refusing to follow the rules. They go on all these crazy adventures with larger than life figures.
My primary relationship to that was seeing a, like when I was in late elementary school, I want to say, seeing a middle school do a play version of Tom Sawyer.
I also saw like, a middle school do a play version of Tom Sawyer in
okay,
elementary school.
I'm glad we're on the same page with that. So it's like, that's my primary relationship to Tom Sawyer. I definitely read it, but I was far too young and it was not like formative in that way for me. I read Huck Finn. I didn't read Tom Sawyer.
Read both. So not to just be like, I'm better than you. Sorry. We don't need that hostility.
No, you are. It's okay.
I mean, you kind of said it without saying it, and I'm just saying.
I mean, so I, it's been years, but that's such a great entry point to think about the Huckster character and to think about
Gus Beezer is no Huckleberry Finn.
No, not even. He's not even close to the level of like wit and cunning that the character has. I mean, I think my more like recent touchstone is Percival Everett's novel James. Have either of you read this? It won the National Book Award.
I'm familiar. Haven't read it. Year.
It's fucking fantastic. Can I swear on this show? Sorry. Amazing. An amazing book.
Fucking can swear.
It's Percival Everett reframing Huckleberry Finn through the lens of James, who's the enslaved person that Huck Finn like takes along on his journey, which is just kind of, it's a fantastic novel that is like comedic in the way that Percival Everett is, but it's also really contextualizing like what it means to be an escaped enslaved person and like the kind of journeys that he goes on, because it's also like the huckster character like comes from and like what Mark Twain is messing with like comes from minstrelsy. So like it comes from like your Briar Rabbit, it comes from like Briar Bear, like those stories that are like passed around through minstrelsy, that were passed around through like Black folktales.
So
those two things are really entwined when you're like having that whole conversation.
When we study literature, unique perspectives is a very consistent thing that you study, from Little Women to Kill a Mockingbird, which is from the perspective of a child, right? There's something about even The Wizard of Oz from the perspective of Dorothy. There's all these tropes across like literary history, but the bad kid, the kid that's causing the problems, but you're still rooting for him. It's like he's like a little bit of an outlaw, but also there's a certain level of innocence. I think that we could easily draw a tie-in through comics' obsession with creating the teen sidekick, Bucky and Robin and all of those. We want that kind of innocent boy to look at the world from. Do either of you have an opinion on Dennis the Menace, which is a show I grew up watching?
Oh, yeah.
Reruns of.
Another one that I have kind of a weird relationship with, because I do remember, I remember owning a VHS tape of like the live action movie from, I want to say like the late 90s. Mm-hmm. I do remember like wearing that videotape out a little bit. So, I mean, that character archetype, I think, is a really interesting sort of jumping in point. I think especially just because those characters are natural conflict drivers, which is a really critical part in any story, is that you need somebody to drive a conflict. So you get this interesting sort of man versus self conflict with those kinds of characters, in addition to sort of a man versus man conflict in something like a Dennis the Menace.
Poor Mr. Wilson, who's just next door to get cucked by a kid all the time.
I had a lot of Dennis the Menace comics growing up, actually. Like, the old, like, chapbooks, like, dollar store stuff, because my grandfather had a whole trove of them. But I was definitely, like, I responded so much more to Peanuts comics, because I found Dennis the Menace to be, like, because he's a conflict driver, I had such a hard time, like, engaging with those stories, because I was like, I don't like that this is the protagonist that I'm following and he's bad, because it, like, makes five-year-old Morgan also feel bad. And, like, for, I mean, I know we're gonna get to Calvin and Hobbes, but, like, for whatever reason, like, Calvin and Hobbes, I did not have that problem. And I think that there's, like, there's something else there that we can get to, but, like...
Well, let's go there. Charlie Brown, Peanuts, is an interesting parallel here, because Charlie Brown is more of the Mr. Wilson character. He's like the nice guy, where there's people all around him, primarily Lucy with kicking the ball. She's more of the problem child, but Peppermint Patty and Snoopy and all these other characters fall into that. So we have this ability, and then there's a photo of me at age 12. I've talked about this on the show once before. I'm walking home from sixth grade in a rural town down the railroad tracks, reading the book Ramona Forever. So if any of you read Ramona the Pest,
they
put me in the local paper, and I got teased endlessly because I was just reading while walking down the railroad tracks. Ramona Forever is another one. We have a naughty kid, right? Harriet the Spy, Calvin and Hobbes. Who are some of them show up for you, and what are your feelings about some of these characters? Morgan, it sounds like you've got some thoughts on Calvin himself.
I have thoughts on Calvin and Hobbes.
When you say Calvin and Hobbes, I picture that like decal sticker that shows like Calvin peeing on something. Right, like that's what I think of every time.
Oh my god.
I have somewhat of a relationship to Rugrats, the cartoon.
You're the right age for that.
Yeah. And in that case, I think it's interesting because you have like Angelica as like the side character, which kind of fits into this archetype, as opposed to like similar to a Charlie Brown thing, as opposed to like the protagonist or the primary characters that you're following all the time, having that archetype being in that secondary role, as opposed to something like the comic we're gonna talk about today, where we have that character in a lead role and also in a interesting other spot of how he's existing within the comic.
Early thoughts, because Rugrats applies here, is also on my list. I watched a shit ton of Rugrats growing up, but early thought here, when we have the naughty kid in modern stories as a shitty little boy, we're way less sympathetic than a shitty little or bratty little girl. Like, I think we have a different energy with an Emma Frost than we do a Quentin Quire, which is already an interesting thing to think about when you look at the problem kids. We root for some and we do not root for others. But there's something about the little kid, right? In the X-Men world, I have an episode on Artie Maddox out there where we talk about, like, Artie and Leech are like the little buddies of the X-Men, like getting into little hijinks. But every once in a while, they see someone get murdered and it's just this like harsh reminder of reality. When you mix these genres together, it's a really interesting thing.
I think it's so funny that your reference point is like the decal, because like to me, like Calvin and Hobbes, I have like very strong memories of like that was the only thing I would read in like the first grade. It makes sense how I ended up here. But like the thing that I latched onto with those stories is that like it's kind of like a stick it to the man story. Like the kind of the brilliance of like what Bill Watterson does is that like he is like, even though that like Calvin is like a problem child and he's kind of a menace, like a terror in that sense, he's never framing his stories in like a way that is like that the damage that Calvin is doing is like unjustified. Like he comes across as very righteous, where it's like because the problems are so mundane. The problems are like his mom wants him to put on his shoes so that he can leave the house. And instead Calvin is like, I absolutely will not do that because you're actually an alien priestess. And if I put on my shoes, that's how I die. And like the juxtaposition between the two of that, of like the nonplussed parents and like Calvin's rich fantasy life to just solve the problem. Because like these are comic strips too, I think is also essential. Like these aren't full stories. Like Watterson's doing like one full strip, so you get set up punchline and you're done essentially. But there was like something about like Calvin's really rich fantasy life, which is all throughout this. These are comic, that I found so compelling because he is just kind of playing make believe. Like that's what Hobbes is. Hobbes is a stuffed tiger that he is anthropomorphized into being his own friend, which is also like so isolating. Like Calvin doesn't have human friends. Like every human, like the Susie who tries to talk to him, who is his next door neighbor, like wants to play pretend. Like one of my favorite, or the strips that I think about all the time, is one where Susie has roped Calvin into like having a tea party with him. And so most of the story is told in like their fantasy world, where it's like, I think Calvin is back in his space adventurer's phase, so he's like a god emperor, and like Hobbes is Stilgar, I guess, and Susie is trying to like have a princess adventure, and then it cuts to them outside, and he's like, and she's like, I don't understand why you won't play with me, and he's like, I refuse, and then it like the strip ends, and it's like she's like trying to like engage with him on his level, and he just like can't do that. And I as a kid that like had a very rich fantasy life that I felt like a lot of the other people in my life didn't want to engage with, and I also didn't know how to talk to them about it, I felt very seen in a way that I didn't with like other troublemaker characters.
There's something so interesting. There's about 5 points we can go on here really quickly, like different tangents that I think are actually really relevant to the conversation today. I'm a therapist in my day job and I'm a sociologist in my thinking, so this is where I go with my academia very quickly. When we're looking at these kids, Charlie Brown doesn't have the rich interior imaginative world. It's Snoopy that gets that. Snoopy's the
one
that has imagination and adventure. Snoopy and Lucy and Calvin are chaos, where characters like Mr. Wilson and Charlie Brown are order. And all of us are grown-ups. All of us have childhoods. All of us miss being able to play and have imagination. All of us can see ourselves as we look at the stories of adult things happening in the lives of a child. And really, every one of these kids has ADHD, but also probably PTSD. So we like really dove hard into the nostalgia of it all. The narrative switch, Morgan, you just introduced, though, is Calvin's rich interior world, this kind of world of imagination. Look at Mr. Rogers, and it's the land of make-believe with the puppets, right? Like, this is such a huge piece of childhood. And when we mix the naughty kid with the rich imaginative world, so much of these imagination sequences that we see are related to larger-than-life adventures, but also related to revenge fantasies. Because, oh, mom wants me to put my shoes on, I'll be the emperor and stomp on the house. And later that gets a little bit more deadly in certain comic books, which is very, very interesting because kids have big feelings and they want a way to express them. So I'm going to toss like a handful more out at you very quickly. Ralphie from A Christmas Story and his entire characters.
Right.
My favorite book for a while as a kid in like fourth grade was Wayside School is Falling Down. We've got Judy Jones. And then we get into the more recent stuff, Diary of a Wimpy Kid and The Adventures of Captain Underpants.
I was going to ask if you're familiar with Dogman.
Dogman, my kid, my youngest kid loves Dogman. Yeah.
Well, Dogman, a metaphor for divorce. What if Dogman, was a metaphor for divorce and discovering your sexuality, which is what it is. It's Harold and George using that story to process their own inner life.
Mm-hmm. Just any thoughts showing up on this kind of correlation between the way adults view children, the tracks of like imagination that show up?
Mm-hmm. I think especially in the context of those stories, it's always interesting that parents are naturally framed as sort of the enemies in those kinds of things, or at the very least sort of existing outside the realm of the story and are trying to sort of break down the imaginative world of a child. But those imaginative worlds are, again, going to take it to a place of Dogman again, those imaginative worlds are kind of like, when you look at that, when you ask that as sort of the way that a child is processing the world around them, and whether it's, you know, you could, I'm sure, do some sort of like deep negative reading about like the way that these characters are using like imagination to escape problems rather than trying to confront them, but also that it's interesting because like the parents that are framed in these kinds of stories clearly like want what's best for the child at the end of the day, but because you're viewing it through that lens, they naturally have to take on these villain roles. But in actuality, you know, nothing is going to come crumbling down because a child engages with a parent. Mm-hmm. I don't know, that's kind of where I was thinking.
Yeah, the themes
that.
Of these stories are, how do I handle bullies? How do I handle responsibility? What is truth? What is justice and righteousness? How far is it okay to step in the other direction? How do I resist authority? How do I understand big world concepts? And when we look at it from the eyes of Dogman and Captain Underpants, my adult brain does not enjoy reading these so much, but you see these tropes very consistently spread throughout them. And whenever you get the feature character of a show as the perspective of a child, I mean, we could go on a long, long tangent here, from Lilo and Lilo and Stitch to Clarissa Explains It All, to like there's a million versions of these. Even Rugrats is the version of babies trying to understand an adult world, you know.
Chad, I wrote my entire undergraduate thesis about this, about like girls in animation and like about girls in animation like going through big hurdles and like trying to uncover.
I'm enjoying how Morgan, I'm getting to know you, but you're like lighting up a little, and you did not expect this in a Gus Beezer episode.
No. Well, I mean, I identified the Calvin and Hobbes stuff immediately, but then I was like, I trust Chad to like take me into some great place. But yeah, if we take it to the world of animation, of like film and television stuff for kids, like there's endless amounts of stories about kids, about like the misanthrope or the outlier or like the weirdo kid. That's what I wrote. I wrote about weird girls. So I even like Coraline was a touchstone. I used Turning Red, movie from a couple years ago, as thinking about like these are stories that are made by adults who at one point were the weird isolated kid, and they are now reaching back to say, this is the story I wanted to tell, for at least in those cases, like these are the stories I'm looking for.
Gail Simone, by the way, has a whole little team of outliers now, using that word more specifically, where it's the misfit kids. Let's talk about this in the X-Men though. So Chris Claremont very quickly picked up on this idea early on in the comics. We need that POV younger character to bounce things off of. We have Kitty Pryde, and then immediately after Kitty Pryde is introduced is the Days of Future Past, and then a little while later we've got Kitty's Fairy Tale. The balance of world devastation and the imagination of a child is a weird juxtaposition. We get characters like Jubilee or Doug Ramsey, the New Mutants, anytime you have a new character joining the X-Men. But during specific runs we have more specific stories, like Squid Boy from the Chuck Austin run, as an example, who's like the victim of child abuse and like just wants to fit in. So there's all these kinds of different tropes. Who are some of your POV X-Men characters when you consider this perspective?
For me, for us personally?
Mm-hmm. I mean, a big one for me, but I think it's primarily just because this was the first X-Men comic that I had ever like really read and really delved into was Whedon Astonishing. And I think it's interesting that that book doesn't necessarily have a POV character like that. Even though Kitty is on the team, she's a little older and a little bit more
armor,
not quite
armor and
that.
Wing kind of take on those tropes a little bit, but God, is it so serious, you know? And then we got Beacon Angel later, but also just, wow, it's so serious.
So serious.
Yeah, and so my other example was going to be like Angel Salvatore, but again, I think the Morrison run is like interested in Angel as like a device as opposed to as a character necessarily. And I think that, so she struggles a little bit as a POV character in that sense,
but it's a woman of color who resists authority and who has a mutation that makes her kind of undesirable, so we already kind of go there. Morrison does a lot of that.
I
kind of have a cop-out answer because I didn't come to X-Men until I was an adult, so this is kind of a cop-out and I hate to refer to her as such, but Kamala Khan was this for me. Like, I read that.
Not only that, but Kamala Khan has been that in the X-Men in the last couple of years as a newer mutant.
Yes, she has. Objectively was published like that. I read G. Willow Wilson's stuff in singles in 2014. So, like, that, and, like, Kamala Khan was my same age. I think she was, like, already in high school at that point, so she has, like, 2 years on me at that point. Like, that was very much my entry point of being, like, this is a character who doesn't look like me at all, does not have the same life experiences as me at all, but I am still understanding the world through Kamala and through the way that, like, she is growing up and her struggles with her friends and with her family and with what she wants to be doing in life, which is simultaneously being a superhero and also writing Wolverine fan fiction. And I didn't really want to be a superhero, but, like, I was gonna write Wolverine fan fiction, so I was like, I get this girl, I understand what she's all about, and that, like, her journey through everything, I mean, even up till now, I she's like my friend I worry about now.
yeah. Weird realization, though, this has been Marvel Comics from the beginning. It depends on the perspective you're reading. Are you reading from the perspective of Bucky or Cap or the Red Skull? Are you reading from the perspective of Peter Parker or the Green Goblin? You know? Franklin Richards, though, is a very key one in that he's born early. I have an entire huge academic panel on Franklin Richards. We explore a lot of these concepts because it's a kid with imagination god powers. And
Anthony
Oliveira and Molly Laser and Property Board, like, we're all talking about that on that panel. If you haven't heard it, I'd highly recommend it. But we also go to the X-Men, where initially they're called the strangest teens of all. That's their initial origin. Marvel later, as you go through the line, they don't like adding children to the mix because they age so slowly at a sliding time scale. But we've got the Power Pack in the 1980s, which is a whole generation of comic readers looking at this from the lens of these little children. And that intersects with X-Men. You see Wolverine trying to rescue Katie Power from the Morlock Massacre, while Artie and Leech are getting yanked out of the piles of corpses, you know? So this is childhood in the middle of it all is really interesting. Eric Cartman, Bart Simpson, Malcolm McAllister from Home Alone. Like, we can go on and on and on here.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just super interesting that it's been archetypal of, I think it's interesting that it's like, I never thought of that as sort of, archetypal from like the beginning of comics and even going even farther back than something like a Bucky Barnes, like going all the way back to even something like, you could go all the way back to, I'm going to take it to a place that Morgan would always love to go, of like Tintin is like a, you know, precocious young man who is like going on adventures. His adventures are not necessarily like imaginative, but this is like, this has always been like an archetypal element of, you know, these stories that were always kind of seen as being for children. We talk a lot on our show about like who the imagined reader is. And I think as the imagined comic reader has gotten older, we've sort of started to phase these concepts out more and more.
Yeah.
I think that's the real reason why we're losing the teen, if we're being like completely honest, is like,
yeah,
if you want to do the historiography of it, like these are like the comic strip was designed for like children in newspapers. And so it's primarily designed for little boys. And so I think that's why you get all of these kind of like little boy characters.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but also you get the hucksters that we talked about earlier with like bringing in
Marvel creators in the 70s were largely kids that had read the 60s comics who went to Vietnam, mm-hmm. came back and then wanted to tell stories. And here we are, three smart grown-ups talking about little kid stuff, right?
Yeah.
But this is right. what our comics are is about. It's about innocence. It's about adventure and imagination. It's about superhero fisticuffs, but there's a heart to all of it at the end of the day. What are we fighting for? Who are we punching? Where do we draw the lines? Now, let's jump into the world of Gus Beezer, because there's a difference between telling stories for kids versus telling stories for teens. And as the father of two children, I'm going to use my youngest as an example. They have always found this type of book to be hilarious from whatever age perspective they are at. They wanted to watch the adventures of Earth Worm growing up. They wanted to read Dog Man. They wanted to like watch the stuff about the bizarre, icky, weird humor. Teen Titans Go was a favorite of theirs. It kind of hits everything from a different perspective. We take superheroes and we give like little kid versions of them, and then we'd sell those to our children.
Spidey and his amazing friends.
Right. Or even more recently, mm-hmm. we have a new 10-year-old Spider Boy running around. Bailey Briggs is a full comic.
Oh, yeah.
Written for kids, about a kid. So it's the same types of concepts over and over. And it's really what our comics are about at the end of the day, but they're also about prejudice and racism and capitalism and like all of the other things that we can weave into the narrative. So we're going to jump into the world of Gus Beezer, and we're going to be silly and serious at the same time. Gus Beezer annoys the fuck out of me. Let me say that first. I don't like how he's drawn.
Okay.
I don't like how he behaves. We see
great energy to bring us in here.
We see a lot of use of like, there's stories going on and then like revenge fantasies and like little comic strips off to the side. It's like they're trying to capture the Diary of a Wimpy Kid format in a comic book form, but it's in really big, blocky, like Saturday morning cartoon art style energy. Gail Simone is the writer of this book, and Gail was known for doing Deadpool at the time. And then we have an artist named Jason Lefko who's stepping in on all four of these books, all under the editing of, I've never met Mike, but I understand he was a great editor. Mike Raked is the person putting together this project. So Marvel also had a line of like Franklin Richards comics, if you guys have seen any of those, where it's kid having the crazy adventures. And they also have a lot of like mini Marvels and like Chris Eliopoulos or Fred Hembeck doing like little kid versions. God, the X-Babies falls into this trope.
X-Babies. I was waiting for you to talk about X-Babies and Muppet Babies. I was right there.
Yeah. I have done an X-Babies episode and more recently one on the Bamfs. And we talk a little bit more about the baby version of all this. Mm-hmm. Dean, can you see yourself in Gus Beezer?
No. Decidedly no. I think it was like, I appreciate that you brought up the sort of Deadpool energy that I think this book specifically has, because it's like when you're actually even reading the physical comic book, I wish I was able to read this physically, because it's the actual story up above and then this sort of like mini story that Gus is telling down below. I think I'm way too analytical and too in my own head to enjoy it, to identify with or particularly enjoy a character like Gus. But I mean, again, I think it's I think that's because I'm now so far removed from being, you know, an estimated, what's 7-8-year-old maybe, that he is, that I have grown so far removed from that.
So I try really hard to enjoy whatever I'm reading, and I try really hard to lean into like, okay, if this is written for like 8-year-old me, can I read it? And it's 8-year-old me. It's hard for me to do this with this book.
That's exactly how I feel.
Be prepared for lots of fart jokes, lots of like naughty children, lots of like, oh my God, girls, lots of like fat shaming, lots of silly play acting. There's a charm to it, but also it's annoying as fuck to me.
Right.
I did not expect that I was going to be like a little bit more on the pro side. I think that the charm is what's weighing is what's this over for me. There's a lot of stuff that is not working. I have gone on the record and said I am not a huge fan of Gail Simone's writing. She's lovely. She's a very lovely individual, and I appreciate everything that she has done for the medium. Most of the time, it doesn't work for me. this is one of these cases. But I think the concept is so, it is worth mining. I mean, we just did all this precursor stuff. And I also kind of like the art. I like that it looks like it's colored pencils. I'm really charmed by that in like a tactile sense.
So were this animated, I think we'd be leaning into Teen Titans Go, Fairly Odd Parents kind of energy. There's going to be a lot of extreme close-ups. There's going to be a lot of weird fucking humor. There's going to be silly things happening to the more straight-laced characters. You know, if Cyclops was in this, it'd just be hijinks against Cyclops all the time, because Cyclops is Robin from Teen Titans Go. Gus Beezer is the problem. He's kind of like more... He's kind of like Mort from the animated series. He's the Calvin character, and they very largely seem to be capitalizing on Calvin when creating this design.
Oh, no, he looks like Calvin. He is Calvin. He acts like Calvin.
Do you want to describe the appearance of Gus Beezer for us, Morgan?
Yeah, so he's got a very, it's very cartoony, you're right. It's a very, like, almost Disney House style kind of, like, face shape to him, where he's very oval, he's very toon.
His eyes are way too fucking big for his head.
And everything's kind of wide.
He's gotten worse. Speaking as a parent of young children these days, all these characters like Disney have, like, the eyes are, like, two-thirds of their fucking head.
Listen, I've got a degree in animation here. It's bad. I'm aware. But he's got these buck teeth. He's the Fairly Odd Parents is a great comp because he really looks like Timmy Turner from the Fairly Odd Parents. Because he also has this like full on like mane of hair, like it's coiffed and
his hair's giving
Johnny Bravo.
Yes,
it's Johnny Bravo, but not styled. And like Johnny Bravo gets a pass any day. That's my feminist king. But like that's not what's happening here. He looks like a little boy from this era. If I just like showed somebody any panel from this comic and said, give me, what decade do you think this was published in? They would immediately say the 2000s. Everything about this tells me that it was written in 2003.
It's giving Dexter's Laboratory.
It's very Butch Hartman. It's exactly, Gus Beezer's voice. I don't like to invoke that man, but...
Okay, so Gus is an established character in the Marvel Universe. Like, he exists in the 616, at least according to the handbook, guys. It's not I used to write on the handbooks, Morgan, if you did not know that.
No, don't worry.
The ability to, like, recognize where he fits into the scheme of things. I do not feel like these books are canon in any way possible, however.
Wouldn't that be so funny if it was, though? I love imagining new side quests for Wolverine, so I love that this could be one. I think Logan should just get to, like, he famously hates little boys, but I think it'd be really funny if he's like,
this is a wild statement. Yeah. I might prefer Dupe to Gus Beezer, and that's saying a lot.
Wow. That's a character we don't have to get into.
No, we're leaving that right there. That suitcase is staying unpacked, and actually, it's not even going to get claimed at baggage.
it's a lot. Okay, so Gus Beezer is a character. There's four one-shots. Two of them are named after Spider-Man. One of them is named after the Hulk. And then the closing one is Gus Beezer meets the X-Men or with the X-Men, depending on how you read it.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage 1. High quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Prenuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
On the cover, we've got Wolverine in a low-cut leather shirt holding Gus up by the back of his shirt. It's not with claws. He's just holding him like he's like
collecting
this kid. But this would fucking choke this child, the way he's holding that shirt. And Gus, I'm not going to do this through the whole episode, but I'm going to give you the first panel of dialogue from Gus in the voice that I imagine Gus would have in the anime.
Please, I was hoping that you would.
I can't wait.
I'm only going to do this once because I just refuse. Hello, X fans! Boy, are you in for a cool story and about mutants and hamsters and brownies and, well, I better not give away any of the sensational surprises in this issue. Anyway, I'm Gus Beezer and welcome to my comic. Normally, I only get to read about mutants in my comics. I have the best, coolest collection of crazy comics in my whole town. But this adventure has real mutants in it. One of those mutants I'm talking about happens to be the guy holding me up. His name is Wolverine. We're great pals. pals. He's in this comic too, so try not to upset him any and just enjoy the book, okay? It's a lot.
Yeah. Incredible performance. Thank you.
You took a sacrifice. You really did a sacrifice for us.
So this child has Legion hair, kind of.
It stands
straight up off his head. That's exactly how I describe it.
Freckles, buck teeth, the hugest fucking ears you've ever seen.
Yeah.
And we open on the X-Men in the training room in a story called X Marks the Mutant. Every page goes between the main story and then underneath Gus's little comic strip adventures. And it's a little bit jarring. Dean, do you want to tell us about the opening pages about the X-Men in the training room, except it's not the X-Men at all?
Yeah. I think the page split is a very specific thing that I was so fascinated by, because the page split, especially on that first page, which I have in front of me, says you should read the actual story that is on the top half of the page. And then once you finish that, go back to the beginning and read the story on the lower half. So it's interesting that they don't structure it like having a B story and an A story, or like a backup story. Yeah, I think, but the opening is the X-Men training in what appears to be the Danger Room, and then one of the characters sort of breaks the fourth wall, and it's revealed that this is actually just a group of children led by Gus, who has cast himself as Wolverine, playing pretend about the X-Men.
This is the cutest part of the whole book. In theory, the X-Men also exist here.
This is the cutest part of the whole book.
The little kids pretending, the little girls like, oh no, Magneto has me in his magnetic grasp, and Cyclops help, and the other kid with the visor is like, I thought I was Wolverclops. Like, just little kids playing, and someone's gotta be Magneto, and like, no one wants to be Cyclops. But when we pan out, they're all just wearing like sheets and like colanders for hats. Very, very cute little imagery. And then we start to see more into the interior world of Gus Beezer through the show. Morgan, what is Gus's relationship with authority?
Bad. He kind of hates... This is a great... He kind of hates them and is also kind of just like a... Like, I've flipped through this multiple times and I can't figure out what happened with the hamster. Somehow, like, a hamster gets involved and on his teacher's head, and then she's wearing a wig. I don't know what's going on there.
The plot is not truly irrelevant.
No. But like, he does have this, like, conflicting relationship with authority, which is kind of... I mean, it's much more, like, a Ralphie or an Eric Cartman than it is a Calvin, because, like, the thing about Calvin and Hobbes is it's, like I said earlier, it's never being... Calvin's conflicts with authority are never presented as, like, this is... As, like, the authority is also wrong.
Yeah.
Or as, like, he is righteous. Like, Calvin thinks that he's righteous, but the strip is, like, so self-aware that it's, like, oh, you need to put on your shoes.
My favorite part of this book, there's no justification for how Gus is acting, I guess. Yeah. My favorite part of this book is something I often see in Calvin and Hobbes and like Family Circus and other things like that, where it's thought-provoking storytelling just for kids. And I think the juxtaposition of what's happening in the main story versus the comic strip on each page is where the beauty of this story lies. Like, we open Gus picturing himself as a superhero. Everything is burning. All the cars are crashing and I have to save it all. Look at everyone. Only Marvel Kid can save us. But then when the teacher gets involved, suddenly he has to take out the garbage with his dog and everything's boring and he just wants to fly away as a superhero again. So you're watching him kind of wrestle with responsibility. He's being a naughty kid. He has two sisters at home and everybody sucks and he's throwing Brussels sprouts and he's in trouble all the time, but in his imagination he gets to go be whatever he wants and fight his arch villain, which is a giant version of his baby sister Tilly. So there's a monster-sized baby stomping around and that part is cute. He also has a dog named Zabu, but in the superhero imagination world, Zabu is Marvel Dog. Dean, what are your thoughts on giant baby Tilly? Because we went now. This is Reptar.
Yeah, exactly. I appreciate the fact that this is a sort of interesting way to have the comic break the fourth wall, because like in the actual story that the above section is telling, except for in that first page, Gus is never turning to the audience and like talking to the audience. But this is a way that we can have Gail Simone, who again, like you said, was writing Deadpool at the time, also do a sort of turn to camera, talk to the reader about what they are reading. So giant baby Tilly as like a classic example of a sort of villain archetype, but particularly in that sort of imagined world of being a young boy where you're like, my baby sister is both the like most annoying thing in the world, but is also ultimately like harmless. And this is like growing her to like massive size, suddenly like is an easy villain for a child to conceive.
So Gus gets in trouble for acting up at dinner. He's sent to his room, and in his room, he pictures himself as Wolverine, claws out, attacking a pizza man because he's hungry. But Wolverine's adventures are interrupted by Gus's mom walks in the room. And this is my favorite part. She's in like a Lady Magneto costume.
And
she's like the parental figure for Wolverine as like baby Tilly's stomping around, just causing chaos. Tilly messes up Gus's room, but he has to clean it up himself. Gus goes back to school and he's interacting with his friends, and the teacher lost her wig because of the hamster, and now she has to wear a blue hat, and she's so mad. But he's in trouble everywhere. Nobody understands him. And every time his mind gets to wander, it's suddenly firing jet planes. This child has really, really terrible ADHD. But then the real X-Men show up. We have...
He does try to call the cops on himself.
Oh, yeah.
I know we were evangelizing Dogman earlier, but like, you know.
Well, he calls the cops because he thinks he might be a mutant. He's like, hey, do you guys need any help? Like, I can be a superhero. I could go beat up some supervillains.
Yeah.
I'm sure you could, 7-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
So the X-Men show up in their Morrison era costumes. We've got Professor X, Wolverine, Jean with the shortest red hair, which is jarring.
What is this?
Among the most bizarre looks she's ever had.
I hate when people draw Jean like she's Rachel.
Yeah, this is a Rachel Summers haircut for sure.
Stop coming for Rachel's bag. Leave your daughter out of this.
Jean did have short hair in the Age of Apocalypse, but this is not that Jean.
No.
Also, she's like wearing like an apron. Like, what is this? What is this fit?
Gus is quite confident. He's a mutant. We get another scene with him out at recess, and boy, do I understand this. I used to table at Comic Cons as a handbook guy. This little nerdy kid, little cutie pie, walks up to Gus and he's like, I read your play, basically your superhero script. And he's like, but you got lots of things wrong. There are errors. For example, you were using spoons for Wolverine's claws and they weren't even adamantium spoons. And the real Cyclops doesn't have a 3D viewer taped to his. It's the people who just take it way too fucking seriously.
Right.
Gus, yeah, please.
Somebody that we've all interacted with in some capacity at anywhere, probably, but especially on the internet.
But also, I
know. Oh my God.
But also, I am that person.
Well, yes. Yes. It's just like, I think you learn decorum at some point, and you learn to be like,
right.
I don't care about the dude.
Gus makes a little board of like, you might be a mutant if, number one, laser beams shoot out of your freaky sunglasses. Number two.
I love this panel.
You have claws and you are not a bear. Number three, you know your teacher's going to say, stop daydreaming, Gus, before she even says it. Number four, you look like a weirdo and aren't even a teenager. Number five, spoons stick to your forehead. Number six, you are an African wind goddess who can fly and stuff. I love that this is on his list. Number seven, you look like Captain Picard.
Favorite thing. Love that.
Very specific thing for Morgan.
Hey.
To look like Captain Picard.
You can see. I just realized that. Is Boimler not in frame for me? For you guys?
Oh, no, I can see him. Okay. Yeah. Morgan's a huge Star Trek fan.
Yeah, they made me giggle.
Yeah, very
specific. I just genuinely like love this panel, though. This is the thing about the art that I like, is that like you can still see the reference lines. Like there's something that's kind of still like sketchy about it. There's something that feels very like authentic and amateur.
As we're talking about this, I'm becoming more charmed by this. I will fully admit. Then reading it on my own, talking about it makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Gus plays with his friends a little bit more. He goes home, there's brownies, he has chores. And while he's reading comics, his friends are like, so what's a Sentinel? And he's like, oh yeah, those guys are awful, but the X-Men will beat him up. And then he turns around and short hair Jean Grey, Cyclops, and Professor X are in his room. He's like, I knew it. I knew I was a mutant. I knew I was special. Should I pack my my homework, my toothbrush? Can I bring my dog? And girl Autumn flirts with Cyclops. Hi, my name's Autumn. Are you married? Which is very uncomfortable.
Yes.
We jump to the next couple of pages where Professor X has to very carefully inform Gus that actually you're not a mutant. You're not the special one. It's your baby sister that you fucking hate that's a mutant, and we're just checking on her. This is devastating. This is childhood destroyed. Professor X ruining kids' childhoods one at a time.
And he's not even kidnapping the kid. Gus would be fine if Professor X kidnapped her.
But this is where Gail's a little bit of a genius because Gail knows who she's writing for. Every child knows this feeling. Like, like, I want to be special, but then you realize with that harsh truth of reality sets in.
Yeah, well, and again, I think that is such a good and clear and easy, because this comes towards the end of the comic, it's such a clear and easy punchline for them to set up so quickly that Simone sets up, that of course Gus gets to live his wildest fantasy, only for it to all come crashing down immediately, which is so archetypal of those like newspaper comics that we have been invoking constantly and then throughout it. And it's I agree, it's interesting that they like, maybe it's because she is like an infant, but it's interesting that they like give Tilly the choice on whether or not to go. Famously, Charles is not super big on giving parents the choice to let their kids go, or Jean especially, so, which I found very funny.
Colt Xavier's over here.
The way this concludes is, I have to watch for my little sister. Like, I'm supposed to be here to support her. And
yeah.
He gets a goodbye. He gets to go out and see the X-Jet. We see Wolverine give him a jacket to be an honorary X-Man, even though he's not a
sure.
And then we have my least favorite panel in this whole thing, where Jean kisses him on the cheek and his eyes go into hearts and he says blurble gerble claw, which is not my favorite.
You know, I agree, and I'll leave it at that.
And then we end. Gus goes back after the X-Men leave, picks up the phone, and says, "Hello, police? Yeah, I'm calling about my sister. See, she's this really powerful mutant. How do I know? Well, she can mess up my room in 2 seconds flat. She can steal my dessert from across the room. Well, don't you have any sentinels or something to just come and take her for just like a day? No. What kind of police station is this? Well, sheesh, Tilly. Guess I better just learn to get used to you." And then she goes, "Tilly, diaper stinky, Gus stinky, Gus changed the stinky, la la la," and he goes "arg," and it says the stinky end. And he doesn't have to change the baby's diaper in his last superhero thought, like, because superheroes don't have to do that. He's not special. So then he went to call the police to ask for a sentinel to come and take his baby sister away.
This is what I'm saying.
This child a school shooter. Like,
this is what I'm saying.
Oh,
that ending,
yeah,
is rough.
And it's one of these things where it's like, I certainly don't think in 2026 we'd ever find any reason to revisit this character, though I did discover that there is a version of him in the Ultimate Universe. That has like appearance.
Which Ultimate? Which Ultimate?
Like, 1610, not the currently running
okay.
Ultimates
that makes
series.
Sense.
But the Ultimates is being published at this time, yes, but please proceed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so there's like, he has like one single appearance in one version of an Ultimate story. This is like when I was doing my wiki dive to kind of make sure that I like was reading everything that I was going to need to read for today, I discovered that. I couldn't find the one Ultimate appearance, though I'm sure I could by doing a little bit of digging. But I think it's interesting that I can't find a place for this character in any way, either within or without like modern 616 canon.
So in the Ultimate Universe, it's an Ultimate Spider-Man 93 in 2006. This is just, there's no correlation at all. Gus Beezer is hired by Mojo Adams as a host for a reality show where mutants are being killed. He has two appearances. He's a full grown up. He's a full grown-up, he's blonde, and it's like a Wolverine Spider-Man team-up.
Oh, all right, okay. Sure, why not?
I may have to hunt that down.
No, you don't need that. You don't.
In 1990, Kurt Busiek, who's one of my all-time favorites, does a backup story in Avengers Annual number 19. For those of you that can track this down, go look at it. It's a backup story. It's about a little guy named Hubie Green, who is a huge like superhero fan. Everything is action figures and toys and posters, and he gets to meet the real Avengers. But the reason he does is because the Avengers are there to beat up the Sons of the Serpent, who are the racist motherfuckers that dress like snakes. And Hubie's older brother, Lucas, is one of the Sons of the Serpent. So his heroes, they beat up his brother. And at the end, he's just like, oh, like it's like his childhood's been lost. It's a brilliant story. Just a one-time appearance of Hubie Green, if you want to go look that up.
Okay.
How are we feeling about Gus Beezer?
I think that this character is of a time and of his time, I would say a little bit too much to be able to reasonably come back. I mean, you never know. Gail Simone is actively writing the X-Men right now. We could wake up tomorrow and there's an announcement that Gus Beezer is making some grand return in Uncanny X-Men for a single appearance. But I think ultimately, by nature of kind of the character and also specifically sort of what the character is riffing on, it's somebody that we can leave in the past, but I'm happy that these stories exist, I suppose. It's interesting because I read the other three stories that are in this sort of title, and they all kind of follow the exact same archetype, which is that, like, he is imagining essentially, yeah, a Calvin and Hobbes plot is playing out outside of his imagination, but within his imagination it's a Marvel comic, which is like an interesting contrast. But ultimately I think we can leave him in the past.
Too bad you put Gus Beezer and Horse Girl in a room together, and yeah, there will be
Horse Girl is calico for your reference, Chad.
Horse Girl. She doesn't have a name.
So March on my show is all about gimmicks. April on my show is gay cowboys. And I do Well, I do character episodes over on my Patreon. If you've ever heard one, I put them out on the main show later. But I'm going to be doing four cowboy-themed X-Men characters. I'm doing Calico by Gail Simone, but I'm also doing Outlaw, who Gail was writing in Deadpool and Agent X during this same era as Gus Beezer. So there's a lot of Gail Simone thoughts coming next month, everyone.
Everyone subscribe to the Grey Malkin Patreon to hear Horse Girl, I guess. You know what this really made me think of? Dean, you might have watched this, and I doubt it if you have, Chad. Have either of you ever seen the Phineas and Ferb Mission Marvel special?
No, I'm familiar with Phineas and Ferb, but I haven't seen the special.
So I don't know if it plays in sequence on Disney Plus or if it's like a separate thing, but it was a crossover episode with the cast of Phineas and Ferb and whatever. I don't think it was the Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes version, but whatever animated Avengers show was on Disney XD at that time, and It plays very similar to this, where it is just like, and I mean, I guess in Phineas and Ferb, it is in continuity, so do with that what you will.
Right.
Because the only episode of Phineas and Ferb that is not in continuity is the Star Wars episode and Night of the Living Pharmacists. And I've got that on brain. Anyway, the point of it's Phineas and Ferb doing a Phineas and Ferb's like plot to help save the Avengers and to help, like, they're gonna fight with the Avengers so that, like, they can save the day, and Doofenshmirtz is like teamed up with MODOK, which is a great pairing, because talk about two supervillains that can't get anything done together. But it's very similar to this, except it's Phineas and Ferb, so there's like a real heart to it, where it's like, oh, hey, like, we're big fans of you guys, the Avengers, and the Avengers are like, we know about you guys, Phineas and Ferb, will you help us, like, defeat MODOK and save the day? And, like, they do, but they don't, like, and they don't, like, become superheroes, and in the end, they're just kind of like, Spider-Man, call us whenever, and it like, kind of plays out very similar, but I think it's a much better version of this concept of it's like having your weirdo kids that are like thinking about superheroes and like idolize them to some capacity, like meet your heroes and still get to like have a grand old adventure about it.
Hey, here's where we're gonna close. Here's the crazy thing that we're not taking time to realize. There is a canon mutant out there. Her name is Tilly Beezer. The X-Men tracked her with Cerebro. What are her mutant powers? And did they manifest? Did they manifest when she was a baby? So I think there's two theories here. Number one, Gus is like, my sister's moving all my shit in my room. I don't feel safe. There's something wrong. I'm calling the police. Gus is the hero because Tilly's a little monster. That's one possibility.
Right.
Number two, maybe her superhero name is simply going to be Poopy Pants because she wants to just, she's a diaper filler, and we see her reference it multiple times.
Or
maybe Giant Tilly is actually her mutant power. Maybe the baby that grows up to the giant size is what she actually is.
I could see her being like Jack-Jack in The Incredibles.
Hidden right in plain sight. Do we have thoughts on Tilly Beezer?
No.
I think that's the pull that Gail might do for some reason in Uncanny.
We have a little bit of a sliding time scale, she could be of age for the rest of those Uncanny kids.
Right.
Sorry to keep whacking those Uncanny kids. I know that there are lots of people who actually do like them. They do nothing for me.
Philly Beezer also could just be permanently be a baby.
Yes.
Well, I guess is there anybody that's still permanently a baby? Richards' kids have all aged up.
Danielle Cage has been like under 3 for 20 years now.
Yeah, that's there a good we go. One. That's yeah. a good one. Yeah. Because Val and Franklin are like teenagers now.
Yeah.
They've been aged up and down so many times.
Yeah, Shogo is still a baby, but Shogo. You know.
Shogo's still a baby. Shogo's a dragon now.
Shogo's a dragon now, which is an excellent choice.
Shogo's having so much fun in Dragonland with his two gay aunts. He gets to do that forever.
Yeah. I love making the show. I love giving deep thought to nerdy things, and I love making new friends. So what an excellent way to spend a Sunday morning. We're recording this at the end of beginning of February, everybody. It will not come out to the end of March, and who knows what's fucking happening in the world right now. So please make sure you're taking care of yourselves, and creation of art and joy and thinking is one of my ways of fighting back. So I'm always thrilled to have new friends here to do that with me. It's great to see you both, get to know you better, and I can't wait to hang out again. Any final thoughts? Where can people find you online? Anything you want to plug for March 2026? Follow the show at @GrayMalkin_Lane on Instagram most readily. That's where I am most active online. The theme on the show coming into April is gay cowboys. So we're going to open up with a script read from the Avengers Adventures in the Old West when Beast is part of the team. There's all kinds of gay cowboys shenanigans going on. And we're going to end the month of April with the trial of the Rawhide Kid, the famously queer cowboy. So be ready.
Shout out Johnny Storm!
So you can find us. The podcast is called Mutant Studies 101. You can find us on Instagram and TikTok, in theory, at Mutant Studies 101. Oh. You can find us on Twitter at Mutant Studies Pod. You can go to mutantstudies101.tumblr.com, where Morgan maintains all of our wonderful notes and citations and transcripts for all of our episodes. And if you are curious about any of our thoughts, you can send us an email at mutantstudiespod@gmail.com.
Wow, you did that so well. I'm so proud of you. I'm at Beaker Barnes anywhere and everywhere. Dean, you can't find anywhere. But if you come on over to our podcast feed, we're probably talking about magic, I think. I think that's what we have. I think that's what our plan is for March.
Yes.
So I think we should have just released an episode about the Magic miniseries. If you liked this episode, we do this all the time. Yeah, I think that's our... That's our spiel.
All right, friends.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us on the show.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Chad. No, it was wonderful.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Hope you're learning things, smiling, and having fun. That's what we're here for. And we'll see you all back here next week. And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern applications. When Jews were forced into ghettos across occupied Europe, beginning in 1939, clothing became one of the earliest tools of control. In Poland, German authorities required Jews over a certain age to wear white armbands bearing a blue Star of David. In the general government and later throughout much of occupied Europe, this evolved into the mandatory yellow Star of David sewn visibly onto outer garments. The symbol had deep historical roots in Jewish identity, but the Nazis repurposed it as a mark of exclusion and humiliation, even as they pushed their own things like the swastika and the German eagle forward. By isolating Jews visually in public spaces, the regime made discrimination immediate and enforceable. People could be identified, barred from shops, beaten, or arrested on site. The badge system also reinforced the idea that Jews were a separate and inferior category within society. And we've talked about this before, but what it meant to be Jewish could come down to as simple as pigmentation of skin or even a drop of Jewish blood in your heritage. Inside concentration camps, the marking system expanded into a complex hierarchy of colored cloth triangles sewn onto prisoners' uniforms. The basic camp uniform was a striped jacket and trousers, often ill-fitting and reused, but the triangle system distinguished why someone had been imprisoned. A yellow triangle identified Jews. When combined with another triangle, it formed a six-pointed star indicating both Jewish identity and some other classification. A red triangle marked political prisoners, including communists and social democrats. Green signified criminal prisoners. Purple identified Jehovah's Witnesses, who were persecuted for refusing military service and loyalty oaths. Black triangles were used for those labeled asocial, a vague category that it could include Roma, the homeless, sex workers, and other people deemed socially undesirable. And one of the most enduring symbols in the queer community to emerge from this system was the pink triangle. It was assigned to men imprisoned imprisoned under paragraph 175, the German law criminalizing male homosexuality specifically. Those marked with the pink triangle were often treated with particular brutality by guards and sometimes other prisoners. The triangle system was bureaucratic in design, but devastating in practice, turning human identity into a visible code. It allowed guards to organize labor assignments, impose differential punishments, and reinforce ideological hierarchies inside the camps. Badges could include letters indicating nationality as well, further fragmenting prisoners into categories. After the liberation, some of these symbols took on new meanings. The yellow star remains widely recognized as a symbol of Jewish persecution under Nazi rule. The pink triangle, reclaimed in the late 20th century by LGBTQ activists, became a symbol of resistance and remembrance, especially during the AIDS crisis. Museums and memorials today display the triangle badges to illustrate how the regime systemized dehumanization. What began as pieces of cloth stitched into prison uniforms functioned as a tool of social sorting, ideological labeling, and state terror, reducing individuals to symbols before they were reduced by numbers. Now we're going to jump back into the heavy storyline we've been covering in Uncanny Avengers. The Red Skull has taken the brain of Charles Xavier and is doing crazy shit all over the place. In issue number 7, hate crimes have begun spreading in the Red Skull's name. Mutants are killed, and the Red Skull faces are painted onto the victims. Rogue notes in one very special page: "We don't take this Nazi down soon, a giant butthole's gonna open in the sky and dump bad times on everyone." Rogue always has a way with words. In issue 12, we see the dystopian future of the Apocalypse Twins, the children of Archangel and Ishizumi. They're in an internment camp created by the Red Skull, and it just looks like those shitty places we've been talking about from World War II. This is where the daughter of Wasp and Havoc is born, Katie Summers, in this future. Giant Red Skull-faced sentinels stand over the camp. Ahab and his hounds are hunting them down, cutting a girl's throat. Kang is watching just out of sync with time, wanting to teach these children that he has plans for what's going to happen when he doesn't aid them. Let's jump to issue 23. We're now back in our timeline. The Red Skull is working with Arnim Zola and Ahab as he prepares to launch all-out war on mutants. And they've built a concentration camp together in Genosha, the site of the Genosian massacre under Cassandra Nova just years before. Red Skull sends his S-men to apprehend the Avengers Unity Division. In the camp, everyone is dressed in white as the loudspeaker broadcasts a message: "Do not deviate from the path. Do not approach the gates. Those who obey will be rewarded. The Red Skull is watching you always. There is nothing you think that he doesn't know." And then there's, of course, a big superhero, supervillain battle. And the final one we'll cover here, the series finale of issue 25, which leads into the Access event to follow. "The devilish thing about other people is they refuse to conform to the wishes of their betters. Fortunately for me, those days are past. The world will now bend entirely to my whims. Genetic pigs polluting our world will be relegated to their appropriate stations. Servants of man, the world guided by one hand, mine, and a fine new hand it is. The population is indifferent to the fate of the downtrodden and marginalized, an eminently exploitable aspect of the human condition, as we both well know." The Red Skull tries making Magneto get on his knees, calling him a little pig, before the Uncanny Avengers fight back. And Magneto soon resorts to lethal force after they found a group of mutants being held as experiments. Magneto begins beating the shit out of the Red Skull and soon taunts him with a painful truth: "Charles Xavier never loved you." The gay relationship implication. "He pitied you, a confused man who let his damage define him, incapable of rising above the dirt. Xavier's greatest fear was that he would die, leaving his X-Men to your inept leadership." And then Magneto crushes the head of the Red Skull, and this act releases the monster that is the Red Onslaught. Because you remember that time Xavier wiped Magneto's mind and then it gave birth to a psychic rage baby? Somehow, Magneto killing the Red Skull here has released the worst version of that. Let me welcome my dear friend Cameron Hebron to the show to talk about this crazy story with me. Cameron, are you a Red Skull fan, my friend?
I'm not a fan. I don't think I should be supportive of the Red Skull's activities, but he is incredibly camp.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your experience in reading these kind of scattered issues of the Uncanny Avengers. This is only 10 years old, but this story hits different in 2026, I'll tell you now.
It does, but I'm also, I feel like it came away with a lot of great, like, Wanda and Rogue moments, especially, like, two X-Men and X-Men adjacent characters, Avengers characters that need a little bit more spotlight. I know Erica Schultz is featuring Rogue right now, and who's on the new Rogue book, the solo issue?
Oh, that's Erica, yeah.
Oh, still, wait.
Yeah, Rogue has a limited series right now by Erica Schultz, and then, of course, Gail Simone's writing her in Uncanny X-Men. Uncanny,
yeah, yeah. But wonderful issues to, like, they're being referenced today, like these Avengers issues and like everything going on with Rogue and the Avengers. So good to see it come full circle.
Now, had you read these issues before? Are you familiar with the Uncanny Avengers?
I'm familiar with the stories, but I haven't read these specific issues because, yeah, this is fun.
Controversial storytelling. Havoc is in some crazy spots. There's some cool shit that happens, and it's pretty well written at the end of the day, even though there's some dark themes explored. The Apocalypse twins and everything else.
Yeah, these stories out of left field, but once again, super camp. Gotta love it.
What were some of your thoughts on the stories that we saw play out? The concentration camp in Genosha, the Magneto Red Skull battle, the mutants being rounded up. Like, there's so many pieces of this that are just relevant to our X-Men themes, but when you see it in the hands of a Nazi, it hits different.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I just did a Black History Month event earlier, and the Nazis did pull a lot of their ideologies from American chattel slavery. So seeing this in present day is kind of world outside your window in an eerie way. Shitposty thought, the Wasp being at the Hellfire Club's orgies is insane.
Yeah. Stay tuned for the very fun trial of Janet Van Dyne coming up on my show in May. I'm very excited.
She did nothing wrong.
I love her. She's one of my all-time favorite characters.
Yeah, and I never really knew that much about her up until, like, reading some of these stories. I knew, like, a lot of the horrible Hank Pym stuff, but, and then her appearance in Ant-Man and the Wasp, but yeah.
That is a tangent you cannot get me on because I won't stop talking. I just read all of her appearances in order in the last few months, and I love her. So anyway, stay tuned for May. Are you an Onslaught fan? And what was it like to see the Red Onslaught?
I love the idea of Charles and Eric having a child together. Like, objectively, they hate each other, but, like, this Red Onslaught thing is, Eric's perspective was very me when my boyfriend's a fascist. Like, and also for the Red Skull to be like, yeah, he never loved you, babe. Like, get over him.
Yeah, so, okay, so let's look at this story from Magneto's perspective, and I'm going to be doing a different one of these conversations on Magneto in a different one of these recordings, because the Red Skull also shows up in the Magneto solo title that's happening at the time. Magneto, who, if you look at Charles Xavier as his boyfriend, or at least his best friend, the Red Skull has taken the brain of his boyfriend, like his counterpart, his ally, his nemesis. Yeah, but also the Red Skull, who is the concentration camp guy, look at Magneto's origins, has built the concentration camps in Genosha, which is the country that Magneto ran that ultimately failed, where the mutant genocide happened. And he's brought Magneto's daughter into the mix with the Scarlet Witch there. Like, this is, Magneto's taking this really fucking personally.
Yeah, and I mean, like, once again, the real world implications of a Romani and a Jewish, like, family being put in, not put in concentration camps again, but fighting against them. It's really eerie and woke, but in the weirdest ways.
Yeah, these are wild stories. I don't know if you had any particularly fun moments that you wanted to point out. If anyone just remembers one line from everything today, it's, we don't take this Nazi down, soon a giant butthole's gonna open up in the sky and dump bad times on everyone, which is just so great.
One I sent my friend earlier, it's Wanda after she visits Necra's ex-boyfriend, the Grim Reaper, and Wonder Man. And she, let me see, I have it pulled up. I decimated the mutant ranks, led all of them into hiding. They were forced to abandon Xavier's dream just to survive. Wonder Man says, you were a puppet. Wanda interjects, or I wasn't strong enough to fight Doom's influence. And then it's just like, once again, me when my girlfriend's a fascist. Like, after watching the Wonder Man series and following up with this, like, I'm kind of loving the Wonder Man Wanda ship.
Oh my god, now I want to do a Wonder Man trial. My list is too long, everyone. I'm doing one person at a time, and it's already a lot. Cameron, we opened the idea today with, I talked about clothing and symbology during World War II and the way that people were forced to portray themselves, and then how dark that gets in the camps. The pink triangle and its origins, and all of the triangles put on people, from sex workers workers, to the disabled, to the Romani, to the communists, to the Jehovah's Witnesses. Like, it's a really dark thing. And then you think of like the social hierarchies that existed among the prisoners in the camps. Like, those are painful pieces of our history. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that or how it correlates to our story today.
Yeah, just seeing this recreated, it's a piece of Holocaust education that you don't really like talk a lot about, because at the end of the day, we don't really have solid Holocaust education in public schools. And it's really unfortunate, because a lot of members of the Jewish community that I know are wanting more education, especially today, with, like, not to say anti-Semitism doesn't exist, but like with the with everything going on in Palestine, there is a streak of a lot of people kind of taking out their anti-Semitism and shielding it in this form of activism.
Yeah. And being Jewish, of course, we just have to state out as a blanket statement, is a very individual and personal family and historical ideology. The atrocities committed by the government of Israel are separate from so many people's Jewish faith specifically, but these stories are still relevant regardless. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, and there, through my work on the local civil rights committee, we found that there is a rise in hate crimes against all populations, but especially like Jewish and Muslim hate crimes have spiked in the year 2024, I believe the data we pulled was from.
Yeah, Cameron and I were just talking about the Arabian Night episode I released recently, which covers some of these topics. It's a heady time to go see my Gabrielle Haller episode. We talk about this stuff a little bit more detail. Okay, my friend, it's 2026. How you doing? How you holding up? We got to go to the Palm Springs retreat together, which was such a delicious and wonderful time. Our friendship is very solid. I'm grateful to be your friend. But we talked about the Days of Future Past there, and like the branding of the M on the mutant eye as kind of an ongoing symbol in our mutant ideology. How are things going for you in 2026?
Things are good. Extremely busy. My time management needs some work, but recently got elected as vice chair of my civil rights committee. Also still working with Clifton Against Substance Abuse on youth substance abuse issues, and just really plugged in and being a member of my community. I do need to remember to like be a person a little bit more, but
yeah. You are a tremendously joyful person, and you have so much charisma. I love how you carry your social justice plans and personal aspirations just on your sleeve, along with all of your nerdy interests and like unique outlooks. And I think you're just a quality human being. I'm very happy
to. Yeah, and same to you. Like the community you're building, especially like a bunch of queer X-Men nerds getting together. That group chat hasn't shut the hell up since we've been.
You guys, there's 20 of us basically that were in Palm Springs together, and we've been like talking every day, all day for like a couple months now. It's group chats, but I love this one. We call ourselves the Great Legs Avengers. all right, everybody. Well, hey, take care of yourselves out there. Stay safe. We're recording this the end of February. Who knows what is happening in the world between now and release, but living joyfully remains an act of defiance. So stand up, take care of yourselves, and we'll see you back here next time for another Red Skull Chat. Thanks, Cameron.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Grey Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Grey Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Grey Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Grey Malkin Lane.